San Juan Regional Medical Center is your community hospital, committed to making life better for the communities we are privileged to serve. In fact, better is our mission, improving lives through personalized health and care. What matters most to our patients matters most to us, offering a comprehensive range of inpatient, outpatient, and emergency care services so you can get the quality care you need right here at home. San Juan Regional Medical Center, celebrating life better here since 1910. Ten minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, the fourth day of August, 2022. Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Micklin. Thank you for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM, over the air, of course, here in San Juan County, New Mexico. If you're in Durango, Colorado, you can tune us in at 103.3 FM. And if you're anywhere else on the planet, we are always available online from our website. You can stream us at KSJE.com, or you can even ask your smart speaker to tune in to KSJE and see how that works out. It works pretty well, as a matter of fact. Welcome also to our viewers who are watching this visual radio program. The program is streaming out live this morning to the KSJE Facebook page, our Twitter account, and our YouTube channel. So we're glad that you were with us this morning, everybody, because coming up, it is my monthly visit with archaeologist Paul Reed. He is here to discuss a new report that Archaeology Southwest has produced about some threats to national parks and monuments throughout the western states. We'll talk more about that coming up in the next few moments right here on KSJE. Then later on this hour, I'll be speaking with Thomas Heuser, the music director of the San Juan Symphony. The symphony is about to start on its newest season. We'll get an update from Maestro Hauser on what he has in store for us this season and much more. That's coming up later on this morning at about 8:40 a.m. on KSJE, so stay tuned for that. Next hour, the classical music continues, of course, with Mick Hess and Roving with the Arts. Mick is back from his well-deserved vacation during the month of July, so we're glad to have him back on the air. That's coming up after the news at 9:06. Don't forget, in addition to Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, you can also connect with us on our Instagram page. And if you're a podcast person, you can find and subscribe for free to KSJE Podcasts. Wherever you listen to podcasts, they're in all the popular podcast platforms. Just search for KSJE and sign up and subscribe and maybe discover a new program that you haven't heard before. Outside our studio, here at San Juan College, it's a cloudy Thursday morning. We are expecting partly sunny skies today, but some increasing clouds this afternoon. There's about a 50% chance of a scattered shower or thunderstorm developing today with a high of 93 in Farmington. In fact, more chances for rain for the next several days. Take a look almost the next week. We've got that monsoon moisture pattern in the forecast. 69 chance of rain overnight tonight, 89 with a chance of showers tomorrow and Saturday, 88 on Sunday and Monday. Again, overnight lows in the mid-60s with that chance of rain continuing, and we will take it. Never say no to rain in the high desert. Let me introduce my guest, who is here with me this morning for his regular visit with me, which I'm so glad to have him on a regular basis. Archaeologist Paul Reed is joining us once again from his home in the Taos area. Paul, good morning. Good to see you. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning, Scott. So glad to be back on.
You bet. Welcome back. And let's talk a bit about this report that has been released just recently, you were telling me, from Archaeology Southwest, which, of course, full disclosure, is where you work, and talking about some of the threats, I guess, to national monuments and national parks throughout the West, correct?
Right. We partnered with a group known as the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks. This is a nonprofit, you know, sort of parallel in some ways to Archaeology Southwest. And there's a lot of folks in that organization who are former Park Service staffers and folks who have a lot of concern. So the idea was to, kind of assess different parks and monuments in the West and sort of highlight a number of parks where there are, you know, pretty serious and imminent threats with oil and gas development getting closer and closer.
Right. And, of course, that's not the only threat, but that's the one that this report is really talking about, right, is specifically on the on oil and gas development. But there are certainly other issues as well for our parks, correct?
Well, right. I mean, we have, you know, the climate change is happening that's impacting especially areas like Glacier National Park, you know, which is unfortunately losing its glaciers through time. And, you know, in some ways, we're loving our parks and monuments to death as well because you know, it's great that folks want to get out and visit places, but, you know, there's a point at which the visitation can be kind of a burden, you know, on staff and trying to keep these special places enjoyable for everyone. So, yeah, there's definitely a sort of a host of issues that the parks face.
Right. But some of these maybe threats are more controllable than others, I guess, is maybe, and what this report is looking at is the, specifically the threat of oil and gas, as we've mentioned. And you and I have talked about this issue in and around the Chaco Canyon area, of course, for a while now. And so that's still on the list, right? Chaco is still part of this report. In fact, I noticed it was right up pretty high on the list.
Yeah, exactly, because we went through the process. We began this roughly a year or so ago, and we're going through a process and assessing different sort of risks for different places. And as we were doing this, it came about that Secretary Holland, you know, announced the withdrawal of the lands in the 10-mile zone that we've talked about a lot on the show,
right,
around Chaco and, you know, several of its outlying units. So that's a real positive development, of course, from our perspective. But it's that, you know, that is a process that's ongoing. If it goes through, it's supposed to last about 20 years, as we've discussed, but it's also subject to future administrative actions. So that's not quite the permanent level of protection that we would like to see. And, you know, as we point out in the report, the other four parks and monuments that we highlighted, at least in this instance, don't have these zones of protection around them. So, and that's something that, you know, we have definitely talked about in the course of preparing the report and in discussions with Park Service and BLM, you know, and other federal agency folks, is, you know, what can we do to protect these special places? So that's a big focus.
Right, right. And one of the things I noticed, too, about Chaco, of course, it's well known for its dark skies. And one of the things the report brings up is that, you know, even maybe beyond some of these protection boundaries, you know, lights from oil and gas activity or just human activity can really impact some of those dark skies. And that was noted in this report. That's something, too, to be concerned about, right? And in a place as remote or tries to be as remote as Chaco is.
That's right. It's an issue for Chaco. It's an issue for Hovenweep. It's an issue for Mesa Verde. And really for all the parks, you know, the other two in the report, Dinosaur, which is up in northwest Colorado, and then Teddy Roosevelt, which is up in North Dakota. So for all these places, they're in generally remote locations. But as, you know, people continue to spread across the planet, you know, cities, towns get closer. And then, yeah, with the ramp up of oil and gas activities and nighttime flaring, the dark skies are definitely at risk in all of these places.
And at risk from even a far distance, right? Some places that we may not think would have an impact, but maybe still can leak in, I guess, to these dark skies.
That's right. I mean, urban centers, you know, worldwide are that put out a lot of light.
Yeah.
Even at night. I'm sometimes amazed. You know, I'm kind of lucky where I live up here, because at night there's not a lot of folks here, you know, sort of this rural zone about 15 miles north of Taos, people don't leave their lights on at night. So it's possible to go out and really see the sky here, and the Milky Way is visible a lot of times. And, you know, so that's one of the values that we're trying to highlight in the report and think about ways that we can preserve that value specifically.
Right, right. And so that's the issues in and around the Chaco area. But as I mentioned, there are a couple other more local parks, and you mentioned the others, too, that are throughout the West that are highlighted in this report as well. Mesa Verde is on the list as well. And I think maybe some folks might be surprised that park may also be a bit threatened by oil and gas activity. And tell us about that.
Well, right. So Mesa Verde preserves, you know, as folks are probably well aware, something like 5,000 cultural, historic, and archaeological sites. And it, and really, in terms of our region, the Four Corners region, it is the largest, you know, archaeologically focused park and absolutely irreplaceable sites within the boundaries of Mesa Verde. It also draws tons and tons of tourism into our area, you know. And I think something like 700,000 people a year, somewhere in that range. So, you know, that's a pretty big economic impact. But there's oil and gas development not that far from the boundaries of Mesa Verde, and most of this is focused to the north. And because Mesa Verde is south of another concentration, you know, in a monument, the Canyon of the Ancients monument, where there is actually oil and gas development that happens within the boundaries of the monument. you know, and Canyon of the Ancients came about in the late 90s, and part of the negotiation for it was to allow some of those activities to continue. And that, as we've talked, I think, Scott, several times on the show, the biggest difference between our national parks and our national monuments is that the parks generally, you know, always exclude activities of, you know, different types of mining and industrial activities within their boundaries. But monuments, depending upon how they've come about in the process of getting those, you know, essentially protected, is a lot of times ongoing activities that might include oil and gas or other types of mineral extraction are allowed to continue within that. So it's some level of protection, but, you know, it's kind of a scale, I guess, a sliding scale, if we want to think of it that way. So Mesa Verde is a contiguous block of protected national park land, but, you know, as with Chaco, right outside that area, you know, there is BLM land and there are developments, and, you know, we don't have oil and gas activity immediately in the area around Mesa Verde, you know, this year or next, as it looks. And that's good, but ultimately, you know, the country continues to grow, the need for energy continues, so this is something that we're real concerned about. If we shift over to Hovenweep in southeast Utah, then we essentially have just a number of isolated national park units that, you know, were set up as sort of a scattered monument. We might do it differently today if it came about, but it's also in the middle of a very well-developed oil field that's been there, I think, since the 1930s. So in that case, we really do have little protected parcels of amazing, you know, mostly ancestral Pueblo, but other groups represented as well, sites and landscapes with the oil field, the industrial landscape all the way around. So, you know, it's wonderful that Hovenweep is protected. But again, as we look at the way that happened through time, larger parcels and bigger set-asides, you know, would have been, I think, useful in that case.
Right, sure. And I guess the way maybe to permanently protect these areas, Paul Reed, would be through legislation so that they're not at the whim of each maybe administration or things along that line. That would be the really final answer to all of this.
Right, that's correct. And I mean, you know, to get whatever piece of land designated as a national historic site or a national landmark or a national park with sort of the full range of protection requires, you know, congressional action. So that's something that, you know, is one part of the process. The Chaco 10-mile withdrawal, you know, as we've talked, is an administrative action right now through BLM and the Department of Interior. And, you know, looking back to 2019, there was a bill put together to do a very similar withdrawal of lands, you know, in the 10-mile zones around Chaco. And that cleared the House. It got into the Senate in 2020 and didn't go anywhere. So yeah, we do need legislative remedies ultimately to permanently protect these areas. You know, and don't get me wrong, the administrative actions are important to get protections in place, but they are subject to the political winds, you know, if we want to talk about it that way.
Right, sure. And I guess the industry would say, but we, you know, this country still has a really big need for energy and a thirst for energy, and so removing some of these lands in some of these other areas, maybe Chaco notwithstanding, but some of these other ones would be detrimental to the energy security of the country.
Right. I mean, it's definitely a big concern. And this is one of the things that we've advocated for in the groups that we've most closely partnered with now for a decade is a balanced approach to this. You know, we've never come out and said, you know, we need to make this immediate transition to a greener economy. You know, I think, though, that what we are seeing with the development of wind and solar, you know, and alternative energies is that, you know, we are making a transition away from fossil fuel. I mean, the use of coal, for example, has declined tremendously, not just in our region, but across the country. And that has primarily been industry driven and not driven by new, you know, environmental concerns. The concerns are there, but that's market forces, essentially. So as we look at oil and gas, I think it's possible to think about a future where, you know, this reliance decreases through time, and where we protect the places that are the most special places in our country and in our region. So that's what we've advocated all along. And, you know, the key to this is to identify areas of concern, particularly with our indigenous and tribal partners that we work with, and then be able to go to the different BLM offices that are doing leasing, you know, because it's pretty much state by state with a separate BLM office at each state level And then the district offices, you know, go through their own process and say, essentially, these areas are special for this reason, this reason, this reason. You know, tribal nations have concerns. Let's talk about how to protect some of these areas. And perhaps these areas over here are areas where oil and gas, you know, could proceed and be done responsibly and not impact the resources, you know, that are of most concern to folks. So that kind of balanced approach is, I think, what I see in the future of what we're continuing to do. And, you know, so from that extent, I'm optimistic that we can go through that process. But, you know, this report is essentially out in order to draw attention to this and say, this is a concern. This is still a concern. It's an ongoing concern. And let's continue this dialogue.
Right, which we're doing this morning. And that's an important thing. And I think bringing in the voices of the indigenous populations that are also impacted and maybe live in these areas or adjacent to these areas is an important part of the conversation that maybe hasn't been as loud as it needed to be recently. We've talked about that on this program as well, time and time again. And so, you know, all of these areas, I think all of them are near Native American populations. And so that's a really important part of this conversation, isn't it?
Right. Absolutely is, Scott. And, you know, through time, the way energy development has happened, a lot of that development has happened adjacent to reservation spaces or directly in them. And this is something that I don't think the country's been great at involving the indigenous populations who are really suffering under the brunts and most of the effects, you know, when that development doesn't go responsibly. So that's something that we definitely call out in the report as well. We've, you know, reached out and pulled together material from conversations with different tribes and pueblos directly affected by the oil and gas developments in these areas. And I think, you know, I think we're working, I think the country's improving our approach. And I think the government under the current administration is really trying much harder to pull in those diverse voices and really be sure that all of the stakeholders get a seat at this table and that we have a complete discussion. You know, again, the oil and gas is important for the way our economy works and, you know, driving those economic forces, but we can do that and do it responsibly and bring in the folks who are directly affected by it, which again is a lot of the tribal nations.
Right, right. My guest this morning is archaeologist Paul Reed. He works with Archaeology Southwest in Salmon Ruins. We are talking about a new report that has just been released, I guess last month, as a matter of fact, called America's Cultural Legacy at Risk, put together by Archaeology Southwest and also the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks, a nonprofit organization. And Paul Reed, as you mentioned, you know, bringing in more stakeholders, you know, the indigenous populations, the BLM folks, and even folks from the oil and gas industry, perhaps. I guess the more people you have involved, that maybe makes it a bit harder to reach a consensus, doesn't it? Because maybe not everyone may agree on the right path forward.
Right. It definitely does. And that's why, you know, these processes that especially the federal government, you know, goes through take months and years to unfold. But you know, we feel, and I think a lot of our partners do, and, you know, from the work that I've done with tribes, I think most of our tribal partners as well feel that this is time well invested. You know, an example of this, and this isn't something we specifically talk about in this report, but is, you know, this unfolding process now for almost a decade with the Farmington BLM modifying their long-range management plan. You know, this started literally in 2014, and, you know, here it is 2022, and of course, we've gone through, we're on now the third presidential administration that's taking on this work and trying to get to a point where this plan is modified, it's amended, it's in place, and the stakeholders, if everyone isn't happy with 100% of it, then at least it's been a full airing, a full hearing, a full discussion of all the issues. And, you know, we feel like that's tremendously important. It does, as you said, Scott, take lots and lots of time. And that's something that I think, you know, in some of my discussions, public talks I've given and just talking to folks who are outside, you know, sort of they're outside the sausage making, if we want to put it that way. Right. They're like, how come this is taking so long? And it's like, well, there's a lot of concerns here and we need to hear from indigenous populations, you know, oil and gas has to have their seat at the table. We need our ranching populations in New Mexico and the Four Corners in particular. They need to be consulted. You know, we have to give the public a chance to comment. So, you know, again, it can seem very frustratingly slow, even to those of us involved in it at times. But, you know, we're a diverse country. We have a lot of diverse interests, and we need to do these things correctly in order to manage the amazing landscapes, you know, that a lot of us, maybe most of us, enjoy at one time or another. And so those are really important issues.
Sure. Very, very much so. I wanted to ask you too, though, the other thing, this is a uniquely, I think, Intermountain West problem, if you will. I think it's probably difficult to maybe explain some of these issues, not all of them, but maybe some of them to our fellow citizens on the coasts or in other parts of the country that don't have so much public land and things that are managed in the way that the lands are here in the West, and the type of oil and gas development and other things that are uniquely part of this conversation. Do you find that sometimes when you're talking with folks outside of this area?
It's definitely true. I mean, you know, in the country, I think BLM manages something like 245 million acres of land in, I believe, something like 30 states. So we're talking about a huge, huge land mass, and that doesn't even talk about the Forest Service lands, which, you know, as many hundreds of acres, hundreds of millions of acres, our park lands, state lands. So it is a very complicated land managing situation in the West, and that's part of bringing all the stakeholders to the table and really having that full discussion. And yeah, I do think that folks on the coast, you know, do occasionally wonder why this seems so complicated, but the issues are important. And I think that the values that we highlight in this report and that we care about, the natural values, the cultural values, you know, the protection of folks living on the lands near these areas, these are important enough, and we need to have this very thorough discussion for sure.
Right, right. Very true. I wanted to go back to this report and ask you a bit about the other sites that we didn't really highlight. You mentioned them briefly, but there are a few more outside of the immediate Four Corners area that are also listed in this report. And I would assume that if folks want to read more and learn more about this report, it's available on the Archaeology Southwest website?
Yes, it is indeed. And there's a whole lot of information behind it as well that can be accessed.
Right. And some of the other sites included, you mentioned one site in maybe North Dakota, I believe, and of course other parts of Colorado.
Right. So Teddy Roosevelt National Park is, you know, an amazing piece of land up in North Dakota. I haven't visited. It's definitely on my bucket list. And, you know, with the recent developments with shale oil, like we've seen, you know, south of Farmington, there are increasing threats to this amazing landscape out there. And there are many tribes who live in the area who are very concerned about that. So that's basically why we put Teddy Roosevelt National Park into the mix. And then the other one is Dinosaur National Monument, which, you know, I went to as a young kid and really helped sort of jumpstart my interest in, you know, geology, archaeology, and all of those things. And Dinosaur has, you know, quite a smaller number of sites is what I'm trying to say than some of the other areas we're talking about. But Dinosaur is really unique because a lot of the lands included in the monument have had some level of archaeological work, but not really the intensive study that we've seen in places like Hovenweep, like Chaco, like Mesa Verde, and even Teddy Roosevelt to that extent. So Dinosaur really has cultural resources that have barely begun to really be studied and examined. And Dinosaur is surrounded by BLM land, you know, in a district where there's very active oil and gas leasing going on. So that one, I think, requires a lot of attention as well.
Gotcha. Which explains why it was put into this report.
Right.
And so folks can learn more about it. And what do you hope folks take away from this, Paul Reed? Just some understanding of some of the issues at play here, and that maybe when we hear about these topics coming up, or maybe if there is legislation introduced, that they could reach out to their congressional delegation and advocate for these things?
Right, exactly. We want folks to be aware that, you know, we've talked a lot about Chaco, certainly I do, and we have on the show, but there are other places in the West that have impacts either happening or likely to happen in the very near future because of oil and gas leasing perhaps not being done in the way that it should be. So what we want to do is have folks aware that, you know, we should consider limiting oil and gas around these sensitive national parks and monuments. And, you know, the best way for folks to understand the issue is to dig into our report and, you know, continue to do their own research. You know, once we get beyond lands that are managed by the Park Service, then this is really about how BLM, you know, does lease sales, which, you know, according to our national regs are still required quarterly. At least they have to consider doing that. And, you know, so BLM and the way BLM manages lands is really the crux of what we're talking about here. And really having a closer partnership with BLM and the Park Service, and being sure that the federal government is doing all they can to consult with tribes that are affiliated with these parks. All of these parks have dozens of groups that claim ancestry and very close connections to the parks. So that's important. And, you know, the other issue is how do as oil and gas finishes perhaps in local areas and perhaps at the state level and more nationally, how do we do the restoration and, you know, the rehabilitation of these landscapes surrounding our national parks and monuments, and how does that get loaded in? Because that's something we haven't really talked about a lot, and this is something that's under consideration with the Farmington BLM Resource Management Plan amendment is, you know, what does rehabilitation look like on a scale of years or decades? So those are some of the issues that, you know, we're wanting to have the public be aware of, and just think about ways to have positive impact. And if folks want to get involved, as always, you know, we have different ways to do that through our website.
Sure, sure. The terms abandoned wells and orphaned wells come to mind. And I think there was some federal legislation coming through to try to get money to help kind of deal with some of these abandoned wells and orphaned wells, especially in an area like the San Juan Basin that has had a lot of activity for a lot of years. And maybe some of those wells aren't producing as much as they used to, and maybe some of those owners and drillers have gone away or sold or resold or what have you. And so I think it's no secret that we have a lot of these sites around dotting our landscape in and around these areas that we're talking about.
Right. There's literally thousands of abandoned or orphan wells. And, you know, with our economic system, companies will go through their own analysis and decide when they're going to sell assets, and then so they'll pass down the line through multiple owners. And a lot of times the companies who end up with wells near the end of their lives, you know, of the production lives of these facilities, they're not companies that have a great deal of assets. So if they go bankrupt, then it's pretty much on the local states and the federal government to rehabilitate and clean up some of these messes that are left behind. So this gets us back to sort of the bonding issue and how much money actually goes into, you know, the state's coffers to take care of these problems down the road. And this is something that we've talked about and our partners have been pretty heavily involved with as well at the state level, and saying, let's require a bigger investment and a bigger bond by oil and gas companies at the outset, so that when all the activity is done, you know, we can actually get these areas cleaned up and it doesn't have to fall on the backs of state taxpayers and federal taxpayers, you know. So that's definitely an issue that's in here.
Right. And that's, I guess, the legislation of how it's supposed to happen, right? Is that when you are drilling or planning to drill, that you put money aside and that money maybe is then invested or able to be then used years down the road as any kind of cleanup, but it just doesn't always meet the price, the final price of what's needed for the cleanup and the closure of a well like this. Is that the idea?
Right. And what we've seen is that those bonding levels are just way too low to actually adequately clean up these facilities. You know, if they're on the scale of low tens of thousands of dollars, what we need is probably at least $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 per well to be put in. And if those funds aren't used, they can go back to the companies ultimately. But yeah, as I said, so often it falls on the state and federal agencies to do the cleanup. So, you know, there's definitely ways we can address that.
Right. And there we go back to legislation again, right?
Right.
There we are. All right. Well, Paul, we are out of time, I'm afraid, again, for another month, but I appreciate you being with us and bringing these issues to our attention. Really appreciate it very much.
Well, Scott, thank you very much. Always enjoyed it a lot.
Great. Great to speak with you. That's Paul Reed from Selman Ruins and Archaeology Southwest. He's my guest here on KSJE. Back with more in just a moment, everyone. The time right now is coming up on 8:38.
Back on the net new